Yeah, let's do it. I'm pumped. Let's let the healing begin.
God help you if you use voiceover in your work, my friends. God help you. It's flaccid, sloppy writing.
I don't want you to be the guy in the PG-13 movie everyone's really hoping makes it happen. I want you to be like the guy in the rated R movie, you know? The guy you're not sure whether or not you like yet.
Hello and welcome to the third edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. I'm Chandon Hemingway, joined by Lee Carlo and Jeremy Fisk. Say hello, boys.
What's going on?
Guys.
It's good to be back.
We haven't actually talked to each other since the last episode.
It's weird.
In 2014. So, you know, we'll have some catching up to do afterwards. You know, obviously, life sort of got in the way of us doing these podcasts, and Chapin had been, you know, periodically suggesting that we do it again, and then, you know, we kind of, Jeremy and I just kind of were like, okay, but then,
that just makes me sound bad. I'm sitting here with all this time on my hands, and you guys are too much of geniuses to interrupt during the day for this petty podcast.
Well, no, I think basically we all just wanted to sit down and talk movies with each other again, because I feel like we missed that.
Yeah, it's absolutely right.
It's almost like a void in our lives. So, I mean, it's going to this round of podcasts are going to be a little less formatted, a little more casual, and it's more, I mean, honestly, it's more about us wanting to do it than even trying to perform for listeners.
Right. And we miss doing it, but what I kind of hope to get out of it is, you know, since we were doing the podcast, I've changed careers. I've had a baby. I got married during the initial version of the podcast, but I'm hoping I can get back more into movies by doing this. It's going to force me to watch more movies and kind of get back into it, because I sort of miss that too.
Ironically, I agree, and I need to do the same thing. And I say ironically because I spend 90% of my time working on TV and movies, but actually getting back into the nitty gritty of watching them and dissecting them and thinking about them, I don't do it all anymore. So it'll be good to do that.
It's working so far, because since we decided to do this on like Tuesday, I've watched 3 movies, and that's 3 more than I've watched in like the past 3 months. So, so far, so good.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about the movies we saw this year and, what we're looking forward to still trying to catch up with.
Well, so, you know, normally, or once upon a time, you know, we probably would review, or, you know, if this were a Fixies podcast, you know, we'd go down the list of all these movies that we all saw together. But I think there was only one that we were able to come up with that all 3 of us saw.
Is that true?
Well, I don't know. Well, we all saw Dunkirk, I'm sure. So Dunkirk, Jeremy, you and I saw it together. Miles, my son Miles, was like 2 weeks old at the time. So that's the last time I've been to the movie theater. And I remember you walked out of it like in awe. You loved it.
Yeah, I really liked it. It was an experience. I enjoyed Nolan's take on it, and basically just putting you in the action. You're living it out with those guys, and the cinematography was beautiful, and I've since listened to Hans Zimmer's score like outside of Dunkirk, and it's almost a little annoying, but in the movie it really draws you in. So I don't know. I just got totally swept away with it, and I thought it was beautiful. And I, you know, it's one of those movies I want to see again.
If we, you know, if we're taking notes on future podcasts, because, you know, we don't want to overwhelm ourselves with too much stuff to talk about today, but a discussion on Hans Zimmer's scores in movies could be an interesting topic, because as, you know, compelling as they are, I mean, in Jeremy, you've mentioned this before. I think you even said it with Inception. And like the wall-to-wall intensity of his score can hurt a movie. But let's save that for another day. My biggest takeaway from Dunkirk was kind of the originality of it, for lack of a better word. Like, it's so hard to go into a war movie now and, you know, find and see something different. I mean,
right.
Saving Private Ryan set the bar so high, especially with modern day war movies. And, you know, there's been so many, but, you know, Nolan did this nonlinear storytelling with it that was a little hard to kind of pick up on at first. But I think was a smart choice. I don't even know for sure how I felt about it when all was said and done. But I think it's what he had to do. And I think it, you know, I think it was the smart choice.
Yeah, it's an interesting way to tell a story about war, right? Like, time is such an important factor in war that is often like hard to demonstrate, right, in movies, right? You can't. It's hard to sort of, you know, show the way time evolves and expands over, you know, the period that the movie is set in. And so obviously, for those who haven't seen it, there's basically three sort of storylines that kind of are coinciding and cut between back and forth from. And one takes place in an hour, which is the battle in the air. One takes place over a day, and that's, I believe, the trip across the channel in the boat. And then I think there's a week is the one that's actually set in Dunkirk, where the British soldiers are waiting to be evacuated. And it is hard to keep track of that and sort of remind yourself that these things, though they are being sort of told collectively as one narrative, are happening at different times. But it's always been something he, as a director, has been involved, you know, interested in. Obviously, with Inception and a couple other movies, I think obviously Memento has that sort of backwards storytelling technique. And I think that being said, if there is a negative thing about Dunkirk, it's that, you know, you are a little bit divorced from the characters. I found it difficult to connect with them.
I can see that.
You're not,
because there's not one person you're following, but I feel like he makes it work in that the story itself becomes sort of a character in that way. And the expectation to see these guys get out of there with the time ticking. I don't know. I think that works and drives you into it.
Yeah, and there's so little dialogue in the movie, which makes it a little bit challenging too. You know, you can't. I'm looking at it right now because I don't remember any of the characters' names. But
well, they never say, you know, them. There's no reason for you to. They, right. They literally never. They like the only person who is identified is Kenneth Branagh, and then maybe the sort of the radio code name of Tom Hardy's character.
Right. So, but even, you know, Tom Hardy, I think to an extent you can connect with him more, but oddly it has nothing to do with the movie. It's that you know who he is.
Right.
So you can. So by putting, you know, a name to his face, you know, you're able to connect with his story and his challenge a whole lot more than you are, I think, with some of the other characters in the movie. That having been said, though, I think the piece I connected with the most was with Mark Rylance's character on the boat. Like, that piece for me just, I don't know, felt so much more personal than the rest of the movie, or than the rest of the other two stories did. Mm. And so, like, you know, I could have watched that movie just, you know, the story of, you know, the civilians kind of making their way across the channel to, you know, to save all these soldiers.
Well, I want to go back to one of Chavin's points of time with it, because I think that's really interesting. And it's not the first time we've seen Nolan do this. It reminds, I mean, this almost entire movie reminds me a lot of the beginning of The Dark Knight when they're breaking into that safe. And that soundtrack is very similar. And the idea of needing to do that quickly and the sort of ticking of the clock, almost literally and figuratively, it's very, you know, it's very similar to what you see throughout the entirety of Dunkirk.
I don't follow your comparison.
You don't remember the beginning of the...
No, I do, but I don't see how you're relating the two.
Because there's, if you listen to the soundtrack, it's the Hans Zimmer, it's that same sort of tick, 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 ticking.
Right, yeah.
The whole scene's really, you get the sense of, you know, they're trying to, you know, accomplish a goal within that time frame. I don't know. It seemed very similar to what we had in Dunkirk throughout the whole thing.
Yeah. Well, what I think was great about what he did with the non-linear storytelling is that he didn't dumb it down. Like, it would have been so easy to, and there were pieces of this, but it would have been so easy to do like that Rashomon, you know, strategy where, you know, you make sure that you see something overlapping so you know where you are in time in comparison to the other stories. And like every now and then you saw like the plane fly over or the plane crash at a certain time.
Were almost more confusing. Like, I felt those Rashomon connections made me kind of disconnect. Like, I couldn't quite understand where those were coming from.
But what I think happened is when you saw them, because you weren't dealing with three stories happening simultaneously, when you saw them, you were forced to kind of calculate the time.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You're forced to say, okay, within this week, this is happening on that day. Like, okay, so is it Wednesday? Is it Wednesday at 2 o'clock? Like, it made it a little bit tricky. But that aside, like, he did that very few and far between. So, and I think that was, you know, a credit to him giving credit to his audience, you know, to say like, okay, I don't have to, you know, dumb this down. I don't have to make sure that you guys see all these dots connected so that you can understand the all three stories happening simultaneously.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that, Lee. I think he has gotten, you know, as he's evolved as a filmmaker, I think there's some pretty obvious ways he's changed. You know, his palette and his scale, the scale of his movies has gotten, you know, enormous compared to where he started, and he just makes these really big, huge, grand movies. But I also think, you know, he also, as he becomes more, you know, powerful and in control of his movies, there is less of that kind of, you know, sort of this is the plot stupid moments in the movie. You know, like, right. We do have that, as we talked about, you got on your first podcast, you know, of Inception, that Ariadne character, the Ellen Page character, is kind of a kind of guides the audience through Inception. But I think you need that because it's sort of such a complicated storyline. But there is very little dumbing down. There was a lot. There wasn't a lot of dumbing down in Interstellar. That movie kind of, you know, moved forward without, you know, the notes to the audience to keep up. You know, he kind of relied on this smart, intelligent audience member, which I think, you know, he didn't do as much with the Batman movies, which we'll talk about eventually.
I think he's always kind of done. I think he's always been good about that. I think Inception's maybe the one exception. Like, even in the Batman movies, you know, I mean, those movies are catered to the biggest of audiences, but I don't think that he really dumbed those down too much either, which was a big part of what set those apart from the other comic book movies. You know, and you look from the very beginning, you know, maybe not necessarily the very beginning with Following, but like, you know, Memento and The Prestige and things like that. I think you said it rightly, they move forward, you know, whether the audience is catching up or not.
Sure, I guess you're right. And I do think that Dunkirk stands out. Like, you know, if the movie didn't look like it cost $100 million and you saw these huge set pieces, you know, the way the story is told and the sort of the lack of sort of descriptiveness that is, you know, typically attached to things, even the lack of dialogue, the lack of, you know, these characters are. It's a visual way. Like, it feels like an indie movie. You know, it feels like the way an indie movie would be told.
I mean, the script itself, I can't imagine that's, like, you know, more than 80 pages or something.
Yeah, it was super short. I think it was like 40 pages. I think it was, you know, it was unusually short.
There's no dialogue, and he's telling this whole story, this whole captivating story, through visual.
So I think,
which is a little bit different for him. I mean, it is different.
It definitely is. And I have to say, I do think that I did not quite connect to this movie as much as I have some of the movies of the past that he's worked on. Even ones that you guys I don't think liked as much. I connected with Interstellar a little stronger than you. I need to watch it again. I got the Christopher Nolan Ultra HD Blu-ray collection for Christmas, so I'll have a chance to look at it. But I am like really impressed with, you know, his ability to make this movie the way he wanted to, you know, with a sort of as little digital intervention as possible. I don't know if you guys were able to see it, but I saw it for the first time in 70mm, and it was, you know, like a film-to-film transfer, and it was really sort of strange to watch it that way. We don't really see movies projected anymore, at least I don't. I mean, there's not a lot of opportunity to do that. And it was interesting to see the way this movie looked on film, you know, on a film-to-film transfer. I was definitely impressed by that. I mean, I'm sure there's some visual effects somewhere, but...
we saw it on the IMAX, which actually I think wasn't great. It was because it kind of stretched it a little bit. Hmm. You remember that, Jeremy?
Yeah, well, you could tell the different aspect ratios would change, and the screen would adjust to the different aspect ratios, right, which sometimes can be a bit jarring when you're watching it in IMAX.
Right.
So, I mean, Dunkirk. Yeah, I'm more with you, Chapin, that it didn't, you know, stick with me the same way that, you know, even movies like Inception, the Batman movies did. But, you know, it's one of my top movies I've seen this year.
Right,
so
there you go.
So you guys coming up from the city?
Yeah, we're just heading up for the weekend.
Can I see your license, please?
He wasn't driving.
I didn't ask who was driving. I asked to see his ID.
Call me Dean and you hug me, my man.
So how long has this been going on, this thing? We hired Georgina and Walter to help care for my parents. When they died, I couldn't bear to let them go.
Do you smoke in front of my daughter?
I'm gonna quit.
She'd take care of that for you.
How?
Hypnosis.
I'm good, actually.
Are you ready for this?
I'm back in the beat.
So look, I go do my research. Apparently, a whole bunch of brothers been missing in this suburb.
But it's cool.
Bro, how you not scared of this, man?
Couldn't see another brother around here.
Chris was just telling me how he felt much more comfortable with my being here.
So switching gears, I do think, you know, Dunkirk was nominated for Best Picture, and a couple other movies where he was nominated for Best Director. And I also think another big one that we've all seen has been Get Out. And, you know, I wonder if, I mean, I think the Oscars have come a long way, you know, from Oscars So White, you know, whatever that was 2 years ago. The Boyhood year, I think, is when that event happened where basically nobody of color was nominated.
Right.
And I don't know, I wonder if they may have overcorrected a little bit this year. You know, there are some people.
Are you thinking about Get Out specifically? Or?
I am. I don't want to give too much away right away, but I do think like they nominated Octavia Spencer for The Shape of Water, which I have no understanding of that. I didn't think she was very good at all. She's good in other things, but not that movie, I didn't think. But, I mean, it's an interesting topic. Like, I think it's great that that is happening. And I don't really know how the Oscars engineers that. I don't know how you sort of suggest to people or to an organization of thousands of people to be more inclusive in their nominations. But, So I wonder where you guys stand on that. I guess we all haven't seen that many movies. I haven't, certainly, so I can't really judge. But
I mean, I think when they expanded the field, first of all, to as many basically, or up to 10 Best Picture nominees, that allowed for other movies that maybe normally wouldn't get in to get in. And I thought Get Out is definitely deserving of the nomination. Is it? I guess I could look it up, but was it nominated for screenplay? Because that's another one I do think it.
I think it probably was.
Screenplay, it was not. Oh, yeah, it was. Yes, it was.
Yeah.
To comment on what you're saying, Chapin, and I'm looking at the nominees right now, and you know, I haven't seen Mudbound. I could be totally wrong, but I'm looking at Mary J. Blige nominated for
supporting. I saw Mudbound. It's on Netflix. It's streaming on. It's a Netflix original movie. So,
is she good in that?
She's fine. It hurts her to be in that movie because that movie's ultimately so forgettable.
To a certain extent, avoid the political aspects of the industry on these podcasts. So, you know, I don't want to get into it too much. I think, you know, the Oscars try to, like you said, Chapin, overcompensate a little bit for the bigger problem of, you know, how movies are cast at this point. But Get Out, I do think, is an example of, you know, things sort of going in the right direction, in the sense that it's not, I don't think it's nominated, you know, to fill a quota, for lack of a better term. I don't know that in a, you know, other years it would belong, you know, with a Best Picture nomination. I liked it, and as we get into it, I'll kind of point out some of my problems with it. But I mean, as far as a, you know, movie that's gonna keep you watching, keep you on the edge of your seat, like it was great.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was a good movie, and I thought obviously the social commentary was huge, a huge part of it, but even without that, it kept you intrigued. It was a good idea. Achievement in directing, I think, is a bit of a stretch, because I feel like the writing was great, the concept was good, but I don't think Jordan Peele's quite there with the other people that he was nominated with in the directing category. I feel like it was a pretty middle of the road directing achievement. There's nothing about it that I would have pointed to that as something that needed to be, you know.
Nominated. So let's get out of the the award nomination aspect of it and kind of talk about the movie itself. I'll kind of talk quickly about my feelings on it and then kind of ask you guys how you felt about it. What I really liked about it is that while it was a mystery to a certain extent, and it was never so mysterious that it needed to have a, you know, jaw-dropping finale. Does that make sense? Like, think about some, you know, mystery movies or mystery stories that are so hard to, you know, kind of solve that the solution is going to ultimately become underwhelming as a result. You know, this you kind of see throughout the movie what's happening. You know, you see the hypnotism, and so you recognize this is, you know, step one, as they kind of say in the movie. So I think that worked really well. Where this movie lost me, and I don't want to get into any spoilers, but was it was a bit of a tonal shift, but it was more the character shift that Daniel Kaluuya has. And I'm curious how you guys felt about that.
Can you reveal what that shift is? It's been, the last time I saw it was when it came out nearly a year ago.
Well, so do we want to spoil? I mean, spoiler. Where do we stand on spoilers?
Yeah, spoiler.
Okay, so spoilers alert. Essentially, he kills everybody to escape. And, you know, I just didn't buy it. Like, all of a sudden, he's this, you know, kind of calm, mild-mannered guy, and then all of a sudden he's capable of this, you know, in an instant. And I get it, that was his only option, but I just,
that didn't bother me at all. I mean, because of the circumstances that he found himself in.
Right, and I understand that, but for me, it didn't work. Like
I would argue that the character shift of the family, even though they had these sinister qualities the whole time, that sort of took me by surprise. Even though it obviously needed to go that way for the screenplay to work, that seemed to be a little bit extreme.
What do you think, Chapin?
Yeah, I think overall, I wanted it to be, and I wanted it to be more sort of transcendent. I wanted the movie to comment more on race and specifically, you know, being black in America and this sort of white world. And I mean, I think that was the idea, right? Like the idea of him going to this, you know, I don't know if it was Connecticut or upstate New York, wherever that was, you know, this sort of white environment where, you know, black people.
Why's it got to be the Northeast?
That's where it was. I mean, it was filmed in Atlanta, everything.
Could have been Portland.
Could
have been Portland.
But I think, you know, it may not be the fault of the turn of the family, but the more fantastical elements of the movie, I think, you know, kind of always, not just in Get Out, but in other films, you know, remove you, you sort of take you a step back from really being able to dive into those issues a little more, you know, significantly. You know, I thought it was interesting, you know, the sort of the hypnotic element to it, where that sort of space he went to when he was hypnotized by the mother, Catherine Keener. But, you know, that aspect of it just, I wanted it to be a little more realistic, a little more real in that way, be able to kind of address some of these issues with a little more, you know, ethos. Does that make sense?
Well, I thought that the you know, commentary that on, you know, on race was maybe too subtle in this movie, and to the point where, like,
too subtle. Really?
Well, it was, like, I mean, you knew that it was there, obviously, just, you know, because of, I mean, they come right out and say it, like, you know, at the very beginning, he asks, do her parents know he's black? But, like, the kind of deeper commentary on, like, where black people stand in America, you know, I like the idea behind what they did, but I don't know, I do feel like it was subtle, like, it was a little bit too subtle.
Yeah,
I don't know how else to articulate.
I agree. I don't know if I don't know if I'd say I describe it as subtle, but it just wasn't. I didn't go as far as wanted them to go.
Yeah, I don't think it was subtle at all. I just don't think it was maybe as poignant as you wanted it to be.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
I think it was a little too in your face, if anything, because of that extreme turns of all the characters, really. But you also got to remember this movie was also played for laughs and it was played for fun. This wasn't, you know, this was a movie that, I mean, I didn't get to see it in the theater, but I heard audiences in the theater really responded to on, you know, on that level of going to the movies and having fun. So you got to be careful with that balance because, you know, that's not what we're describing is not necessarily the movie that Jordan Peele was trying to make.
No, I think you're exactly right. It was fun. It was laugh out loud funny at a lot of places in the theater.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a tough thing to wrestle with, right? Like, people use genre and our expectations of how genres will unfold as a tool, and I think he does that here. You know, but it's almost as if, you know, you take that frame of this very sort of serious topic and you place it in this sort of storyline that you can see where it's going because it's been, I can't tell you exactly which movie it's been done before in, but it's a familiar trope, right? Like this idea of the outsider coming to a place that he doesn't understand and then, you know, things are not as they seem and they turn against him, right? I mean, this is a common storyline. Right. And so,
I mean, I watching it personally, I knew it was going to go someplace dark and a little bit scary, but I really had no idea they were going to go as far as they did. I didn't know where they were. It ultimately was going to go, and I was a little bit surprised by that, not in a good or bad way necessarily. It wasn't so obvious for me watching it, but
yeah, maybe with me. I think one of the best moments of sort of all those things working together, which, you know, I didn't totally buy in with, but is the moment at the end, again, spoiler alert, to where the friend shows up in the cop car, and basically the main character has, you know, essentially, at that time point, had he killed Allison Williams? I think he had.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think he just finished killing then you see the blue lights, the cop car, and you think it's definitely going one way.
Right.
And somewhere else.
And sort of that,
like, I was hoping we could avoid talking about his friend in this podcast.
Why?
Because he's so bad in this movie. It's so
it's fine.
That character was so poorly written, and it was a necessary character, but like, and I don't even blame the actor, but that it was just such a one-dimensional like buddy that reads all these like fan fiction type things, so it develops these ridiculous theories, but then oh my god, he was right about what was happening. I thought it was so stupid.
Really, I thought he was funny. I mean, I thought he was. Whenever it cut back to him, I was like, "All right, we kind of need this now. It's kind of getting a little too dark and weird."
Yeah.
Well, I guess I think like it sort of depends how you approach the movie, because you guys are talking about the comedy element of it, and while it was definitely there and like I recognized it, but I didn't get that from this movie. Like, and it wasn't really part of my expectation going in, and it wasn't really part of the experience I had with it. So. The comic relief wasn't necessary for me. I was okay with this movie taking these dark turns and kind of continuing with it. So maybe that was part of why he was so out of place for me.
I mean, we can go debate that. But I kind of going back to that moment, I think what was nice about that particular moment is that, inevitably you put yourself in the shoes of the protagonist of these horror movies. You feel the tension that he's in. And, you agree with and sympathize and empathize with him killing all these people. You want him to, as the movie says, get out. You want him to survive. And then that police car shows up, and suddenly you're back in this sort of politicized environment. And you feel the fear that this guy feels. And what I think black people feel about, cops, which, as a white person you may not understand. And I think that moment really, really worked nicely. And then suddenly the friend emerges, the sort of the comic relief throughout the entire movie. And it's this big relief, kind of beautiful, fun moment. And it really just kind of brought the movie together for me. So
I agree with you 100% on that moment leading up to when you see it's the friend. Like, and it's the perfect plant and payoff with the scene at the beginning when they hit the deer. You're set up to think to a certain extent that the deer has something to do with, the mystery in this movie,
right.
The way that's shot. But it's just as simple as that you get, a cop that actually really wasn't, I don't think, racist, right? Like, it's sort of just the implication that they create with Allison Williams telling him that it's bullshit that he has to see the guy's ID. And then you sort of just forget about it. But it's perfect at the end when you see the cop, because you kind of are forced to assume it's going to be the same cop, and you're going to be, and he's going to just lose. It's the fact that what it turned out to be, when it turned out to be his friend, the fact that was not only a relief, but a comic relief, I think was out of tune with the tone of the rest of the movie.
Hmm.
All right. So, real quickly, I think we wanted to maybe cover a couple more movies, but Chapin, I know you kind of had a point that you wanted to gear towards Jeremy and a couple of movies he worked on.
Yeah, I mean, I think, Jeremy and I, Jeremy works on big, huge movies that film in Boston, and I, in my own little way, am still working on commercial projects, which is, basically like 30-second little movies, right? We're still kind of in it, and I think it'd be interesting. I don't want to get too politicized. I don't want to talk about necessarily the whole Me Too movement. But when that was going on, I had all these thoughts about that kind of stuff and working on big movies that I thought would be great to talk about on the podcast. So we're a little late, but we might as well do it, I guess. As I've been doing this for like 4 or 5 years, I just appreciate working with people that are nice and fun and easy to work with, and there's this idea that I feel like is sort of under the skin of this entire, bad men behaving badly in Hollywood storyline that somehow sort of genius and talent are mixed in with this idea that you've got to be this eccentric kind of out of control person. And I guess what I've been trying to say is that I have so moved away from the people that I feel like are like that. I've moved to working with people who are easy to work with, who are not big personalities, and Anyways, I thought I would ask you about that. You've worked with some big talent. You've worked with some people who have definitely famously behaved badly. And I was wondering, you know, if you can share some of those sort of out of control stories. And to me, that is the sort of unsung point here, is that there's all this outrageous behavior and they affect people at work. And I don't know. That was kind of a long-winded way.
I do think it's an interesting point you bring up about the genius, or quote-unquote genius of it, and people being just sort of, for lack of a better word, assholes. I mean, so just to be clear, I work in the locations department on these movies and TV shows. So basically, I'm in charge of everything between finding the locations and then dealing with the logistics of the locations once a director or filmmaker has decided that we're going to shoot somewhere. So, it's, you know, despite what everyone thinks, you just don't show up with a crew of 120 people on the day and just start shooting. I mean, there's a lot of logistical things that have to go into every location you shoot at, and a lot of movies, you know, you could have 50, 60 locations, up to 100 different locations. And if it's a period piece, that becomes that much more difficult because now you're clearing streets, changing out street lights, you know, stuff like that. So, and the reason I bring that up is because I don't work directly, you know, with the bigger talents. I'll work with maybe directors early on when we're scouting and we're all in a scouting van together going from location to location trying to figure out where we want to shoot. But other than that, you know, I don't work with a lot of the big, you know, directly with a lot of those, you know, big name actors or filmmakers. But that being said, you definitely, and the culture's changing, Japen, and it's definitely true as far as working with people who just aren't agreeable and how much more difficult that is. And I think people are realizing, putting aside the whole Me Too movement, but just like people are realizing that, you know, it's almost better to, you know, deal with people that you want to be around. And I, you know, over the last few years, you can kind of see that the crews that are, you know, the cream of the crops, out here in Massachusetts, I mean, most, not everyone, but most people are relatively agreeable and easy to work with. And that's definitely changed because there's this, you know, there's this concept that you need to be not only sort of, like, you need to go through the difficulty of working with difficult people to make it worthwhile. It's like a badge of honor. And it used to be the same way about working all these hours, working 18, 19, 20 hours. I mean, it's still there. You still have to do it. But, you know, there's more grains of, you know, like the production will put you up in a hotel if you've worked 19 hours because they don't want you driving home. But before, when I first started, it was like that was sort of a badge of honor to be able to work the 20-hour day and then go home and then come back in 6 hours, you know. So I don't know. I agree with you, though, that, you know, things need to change, and they are. The culture is changing slowly.
I think you're in an interesting position because, as you said, you're not always, you know, working side by side with the director. But you do have to deal with the fallout of some crazy decisions because you're the person who has to liaise with the community. You know, mm-hmm. I think all in all, Massachusetts has benefited a whole bunch from the increase in production that's been done there. And you're someone, you know, who you've made a career out of it, you as well as, you know, thousands of other people. But the inconvenience that especially you have to deal with talking to the communities and stuff, and these sort of outrageous decisions that basically one person makes, or maybe a couple people do for no seemingly reasonable reason, have these effects that ripple out to the community. And
exactly.
And it's just, I don't know, like...
So here's the thing. Like, I don't think a lot of these, like, directors or whatever realize the sort of cascade or the, you know, when they make a decision, the ramifications of it going downhill, if you know what I mean. Like, Data, I don't think a lot of them know, because there's still that point where everything is disguised and sometimes warranted as being a creative decision. So everything's serving the creative process of the movie. So if they decide, you know, one day that they're, instead of shooting during the day in a neighborhood, you know, while we have a gunfight, they're like, no, we can't, for example, we can't tent in the house anymore after, you know, I've already told a whole, you know, community and city that we're going to be shooting during the day to avoid all the loud noises. And then they decide, no, doesn't work. We have to shoot this at 2 o'clock in the morning. I don't know if they...
What's happening? Oh, are we playing a clip
sorry,
here?
Sorry, go ahead. Sorry, my bad.
I thought that was nice, like you were fading in a clip of a movie where they were shooting at 2 o'clock in the morning.
I don't know if those people who make the decisions, actually I know that they don't really either, they don't know what their decisions are doing to a lot of people, or, you know, they just, their focus is on just getting the shots and getting the movie they want. So it's a balancing act. And part of it's on my end too, is I've gotten better over the years of taking it personally and trying not to let it get to me, and also being as truthful to the people I'm talking to, that, you know, things could change and that we're not an exact science. So yeah.
You know what you said, Jeremy, that I think is just really accurate. It is, in your, you know, referring to the, you know, the hours that you that people on these movies work, and that it's sort of a badge of honor. But I feel like that's just inherent in people, and it translates across the entire, well, everything. But within the industry, you know, getting, you know, the director's thought process isn't so much, you know, from a neglectful standpoint, or from a, you know, trying, you know, not thinking about the other people that he's working with, but he's thinking like, look, this is, you know, this is my project. This is what I have to do. I have to get it done. And everybody kind of cascading down, you know, understands that the grueling aspects and these horrible conversations that you as a location manager have to have with, you know, the entire neighborhood is this stamp, this badge of honor that you then say, like, this is what I've had to go through. You know, it's the same, you know, stamp that people kind of wear proudly, that they, you know, they worked through the production assistant days, or like that, even if you want to kind of go in another direction and, you know, the if I can make it here, I can make it anywhere philosophy about living in New York City. You know, it's this badge of honor that I think is inherent with human beings that kind of just applies really to the film industry and working on movies. That so everything that's being done, and as outrageous as the hours are, and, you know, some of as outrageous as some of the things that directors ask for, you know, the people getting them done sort of wear it as that badge of honor, like you said.
Yeah, and that's a little bit, I mean, for sure. And
I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. Like, I just think it's a little exists.
Bit too. Yeah, it's the culture is changing a little bit, and it's good to see. You know, I definitely don't try to, like, you know, add the extra hours or the extra stress if I don't need to anymore.
But that's don't you think that has changed because you've been doing it longer? Like, put yourself back in your shoes 10 years ago.
Yeah, no, you're maybe you're right.
And obviously, like, you know, life, you're married now, you know, and things like that. But take all of that out of the equation. Mm-hmm. You know, you might just be tired of working that many hours and realize that you don't have to do it anymore. Like,
yeah, you're right.
That's not necessary. But when you're first coming up, like, you almost need to earn that badge so that you can wear it and people can see it, because everybody else had to go through it.
Yeah, no, that's 100% accurate. And you definitely have those moments when you see somebody else either not doing it when, you know, starting up, or doing it, and you say to yourself, well, yeah, I mean, I've been there. Or this person's not going to make it because they're not willing to put in that time.
Right, and that's the piece that needs to change, right? Because yeah. But it's a perception, and that's obviously the hardest thing to change.
But yeah, I mean, so this year there were two movies that came out this year that I did work on. in Boston or Massachusetts, I should say. One of them's pretty obvious. It was shot here. It was Stronger, with Jake Gyllenhaal, about Jeff Bowman and, you know, the Marathon bombing. And the other one is not obvious that it was shot here, because it's called Detroit, directed by Kathryn Bigelow. And we made Detroit 1967 here in Boston and the surrounding areas. Both were, you know, had their ups and downs. Detroit, definitely, because it was a period piece. It took place, you know, in a different time. I mean, a different place than we had. It was a lot of things, but that movie was extremely difficult to work on. But I think there was a sense with all of us that we were making something good and important, and something that was the sign of the times. And, you know, it didn't, I don't think, ultimately turned out how we had all hoped.
It did terribly.
It did terribly at the box office. I don't know. Did either of you guys see it?
I haven't seen it.
Yeah, I mean, there's just something that didn't really work about it, and it's hard to even articulate what it was. I mean, I think the biggest thing was we didn't really have a character when you're watching it to kind of follow. And there was this John Boyega's character that was supposed to be that character, but you also kind of wondered, what is he doing there? Why is he still, you know, a participant? And I don't know, it's just there. It was a little bit messy. It felt like two different movies, one about the entirety of the Detroit riots in 1967, and then one about this specific horrible incident that happened at the Algiers Hotel in Detroit. I was super disappointed in it. I wish you guys had seen it, just to, out of curiosity, so you can compare it to the other Kathryn Bigelow movies, that like Zero Dark Thirty and The Hurt Locker, that really worked, I think.
I mean, it's a, you know, it's something I would like to catch up with, right? You know, given my current situation, it's so much easier for me to watch movies when they come on demand or on DVD. Yeah. So, right. You know, I imagine I'm going to catch up with a lot of 2017 movies within the next several months. So, you know, rather than us, you know, having a podcast where we talk about the latest movie in theaters, it might be something, you know, that we can revisit and talk about together.
Yeah. And as far as, I don't know if either of you saw Stronger, but I think that movie really worked. And I think it was a much better movie than Patriot's Day, which also was shot here in Boston.
Patriot's Day wasn't very good, though. So. Yeah.
Patriot's Day just, you know, was sort of the, unfortunately, like the Jason Bourne of the Marathon bombing movies. You know what I mean?
See, to me, it was the one that, like, so I haven't seen Stronger yet, but to me, Patriot's Day was the move. Like, so, I mean, take all the whether or not making these movies was either necessary or too soon or whatever, but like Patriot's Day to me was the movie that was almost like the made for TV one that they had to make as quickly as possible. So that like we could remember how we got past this.
I think
you know, like, what I mean? Like
Peter Berg's concept of it was maybe he came from a good place with it and he wanted to you know, treat it with respect and
I'm sure that those were his intentions.
I'm sure those were his intentions, but ultimately came off like an action movie.
Yeah.
You know, that just didn't feel necessary. Whereas Stronger was more about one person's, you know, struggle with what happened in their rehabilitation and this and that character who was flawed, how they were dealing with such a traumatic event.
Well, and it's a story that we don't know either.
Not as well. Which, I mean, we all know right. Jeff Bowman and we've seen the picture and whatever, but it's
more important than for us to just watch a recreation of the, you know, the week long events.
The worst week of Boston's history in a while, you know, then, Patriot's Day for me didn't work, but I would recommend people to see Stronger. I really think it, you know, captured something about the city and about those individuals that really worked. And the director David Gordon Green he was definitely not one of those assholes we were talking about. He's a super nice guy, easy to work with, down to earth. And I think he's a pretty good filmmaker when he wants to be, too. So I was glad to see him make the movie he wanted.
That's interesting. So, Jeremy, before we close on that topic, I was wondering, from your perspective, you kind of admonished yourself from, you know, not being particularly involved always in the creative part of it. But do you sometimes feel like you can get an idea of the way these movies are going to go when you're working on them? Does the spirit, the general feeling, you just identified David Gordon Green, the leadership of the movie, yeah, the quality of their work. Do you feel like you get a?
I wish I could, because I thought despite how difficult it was on me and on the crew, that there's something about Detroit that felt like we were gonna make a good movie here, and it didn't necessarily pan out that way. And I finished a movie last summer with Josh Boone, he's the director of the new X-Men movie that we worked on, and nicest guy in the world. I want to work with him again, like, in the future. It was one of my favorite film experiences to do, but I don't know in the end of the day if that movie's going to work. So it's weird, you know. I don't know. The answer is I don't know, and I don't think anyone knows, and that's why this is such a weird and interesting business, because it's a bit of a crapshoot. And I think, like, you look at Detroit and you look at the trailer and you look who's involved and who wrote it, Mark Bowles, who wrote Zero Dark Thirty and The Hurt Locker, and Catherine Bigelow, who directed it. I mean, everybody, you know, all, I'm sure, was expecting, you know, that movie to really work and really, you know, even, you know, especially nowadays with everything that's going on with Cops and you know, come out and say something new about this. And unfortunately, you know, it just fell a little flat. And I wish I could tell by being on that set every day what's ultimately going to happen. But you guys know, as well as anybody, you know, half the movie's made in the editing room where, you know, I'm no part of.
Are you so desperate to fight criminals that you lock yourself in to take them on one at a time?
Actually, there were seven of them.
I counted six, Mr. Wayne.
How do you know my name?
The world is too small for someone like Bruce Wayne to disappear, no matter how deep he chooses to sink.
Who are you?
My name is merely Ducard, but I speak for Ra's al Ghul, a man greatly feared by the criminal underworld. A man who can offer you a path.
What makes you think I need a path?
Someone like you is only here by choice. You have been exploring the criminal fraternity, but whatever your original intentions, you have become truly lost.
This is sort of something that we've been kind of tossing around for a while, and it's essentially the Batman Begins versus the Dark Knight debate.
10 years
later.
Which
one's a better movie? And which one's a better movie? And I mean, you know, if you ask the majority of fans and critics, the consensus is going to be the Dark Knight. You know, my feeling is that Batman Begins is a better movie, but I'll preface it by saying, you know, that isn't taking anything away from the Dark Knight. I mean, that movie is so well written. I mean, you know, even just like the more obvious lines are kind of bookended by, you know, kind of subtle lines of dialogue. And the example I'll give is the, you know, the line that Aaron Eckhart says, where he says, you either die a hero or you live long enough to become the villain, obviously foreshadowing what's going to happen with him later in the movie. You know, but that's set up so brilliantly by this story of Caesar and their, you know, their discussion of, you know, where the direction that Gotham is going. And, you know, the writing in that movie is so good. And, you know, the little bits and pieces that they sneak in about the cop's mother being in the hospital, and that's why she kind of becomes dirty. And, you know, all that stuff is so smart. And then, of course, you have a generational performance from Heath Ledger. But that piece in particular, I think, is what kind of clouds people's judgment a little bit, because all you ever hear is that that the Dark Knight has a better villain. And I would argue that while it has a really great performance of its villain, I don't know that it necessarily has a better villain. I think that Liam Neeson as Ra's al Ghul in and the whole League of Shadows element of Batman Begins is so like subtle and smart and clever and just works like so seamlessly with the whole idea of what Batman is, and that is this kind of ninja and this like, you know, essentially a bat, and you can't see him, and the fight sequences in Batman Begin work so consistently with that, and I think it just ties together so much more nicely, whereas The Dark Knight for me is almost too epic in scale, and it's forced to kind of show everything a little bit too much. You know, that's sort of my intro argument for Batman Begins.
What do you mean by when you say is forced to show too much? Show too much of what?
So the simplest example that I always use is the fight scene. So take a fight scene and specifically the fight scene in Batman Begins when he kind of first shows up at the docks where he takes out Falcone. You know that, you guys know the scene I'm talking about?
Yeah.
And he's just, you barely see him. And they even have Tom Wilkinson kind of like looking like, what is going on? I can't figure it out. You know, and then the fight sequences in the movies, you know, leading all the way up into The Dark Knight Rises, which we're not going to get into, they sort of devolve into these just Hollywood stylized fight scenes where there's no mystery to them. There's no, you know, Batman's no longer hidden. He's just out in the open, and I feel like that's sort of a kind of a small example of how the entire movie of The Dark Knight is in comparison to Batman Begins.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I think a big sort of visual motif of that movie is getting Batman, the character, and the movie out in daylight. You know, like you never. They even talked about in designing the costume, like you don't really see that the costume in broad daylight very often in sort of all of those movies, every iteration of Batman. And so in designing the costume, they had to, you know, make it in a way that it could be seen in daylight and under, you know, proper lighting. But that is sort of anathema to that. It's sort of the opposite of what Batman is this character that hides in the shadows and he's, a secret kind of detective person who no one knows who he is. And anytime you sort of take that character and you put him in broad daylight and you place him in a place where he can be seen, you're immediately removing some of the mystery surrounding him, both in the context of the story of the movie, and that, like, you know, now he's not, he's talking to Commissioner Gordon in a bank vault versus on top of a building somewhere in the middle of the night, but also for the audience, like the audience can see this character, you know, and the machinations of how he works and that sort of, and what was so smart about Nolan's take on this in Batman Begins was that, you know, that aspect of the character was explained and was you suddenly understood why he had to be that way, because it was about fear and instilling fear in enemies and this and the symbolic nature of that, and you kind of, you know, he spent a movie kind of creating that, and then I think what you're identifying, Lee, is that he sort of threw that away in the second movie.
Yeah, to a certain extent, and I just think you said it well. Like, he's, you know, Batman is shrouded in mystery and he's, you know, in the shadows, and that's why, like I said, like the fact that he was trained by a group called the League of Shadows, and through his whole training sequence he goes through these sequences where he's, you know, he's either hiding or he's forced into finding somebody to learn how best to hide. And still accomplish what he needs to accomplish. And then, you know, I hate to use the term, you know, Hollywoodized or dumbed down to an audience, because Christopher Nolan is so good at not doing that. And we talked about that earlier with Dunkirk. But, you know, the bank vault scene is a perfect example. And like, it was a little bit more of a avenue to showcase all of Batman's toys in The Dark Knight than it was in Batman Begins, where you're more looking at kind of the evolution of a character.
Yeah, I mean, look, I get what you guys are saying, and ultimately, for me, it's such a cop-out, but, like, the enjoyment that I got out of, you know, The Dark Knight just was way more than I did Batman Begins. And to argue your point about the villainly, it's like, yeah, you know, maybe, like, yes, that the performance was so wildly good and iconic that you're basically dismissing it as sort of a distraction. But, you know, what is the villain? It's a performance, you know? It's a performance by an actor.
Well, so that's not really what I'm trying to say. I think, unfortunately, when people are having this conversation, or when I bring up this conversation about, you know, which of these movies is better, the argument for The Dark Knight always goes to Heath Ledger as the Joker.
It's a valid argument because it brings, I mean, a villain in a Batman movie is important. It's really important, and it gives Batman sort of an equal that I don't think Ra's al Ghul was ever really, you know, that. I don't know. It's just, Heath Ledger's performance definitely has something to do with it, and it's hard to just dismiss it.
Well, and I mean, not that it needs any additional credit, but the great thing about his performance in that movie is that it isn't, in my opinion, bigger than the movie. I think it worked perfectly in the movie. You know, you think of some of these scene-chewing performances, you know, and they just become bigger than the movie. Like, the first thing that comes to mind for me is Daniel Day-Lewis in Gangs of New York, like, in such a sort of forgettable movie, but yet such a, you know, amazing performance. But here you have, you know, Ledger as the Joker, and like you said, he sort of is Batman's match, and he's not afraid, and, like, they work that, you know, the explanation of him so perfectly into the movie with Michael Caine, and, you know, he's so good in these movies, but, you know, talking about his last trip to Burma when the guy just wanted to watch the world burn, and it's just all these little things they do with the writing make a performance like that work within the movie. So, like, I don't discredit the performance at all. What I don't like is that it's used as people's argument that it's a better movie, and as a result, they're dismissing, you know, the villain in Batman Begins, which I think is just so smart. And, like, you don't – and I think what makes Batman Begins, you know, such a great movie is that it doesn't have the Joker. It doesn't have the Riddler. It doesn't have the Penguin. It has this sort of humanized element to the movie that just is so set in reality that, you know, it just it allows you to accept – Bruce Wayne as a man as well.
I mean, you may disagree with this, but I think there's one other thing that makes The Dark Knight better than Batman Begins, and it's a word we usually use, but we haven't used it so far, but the stakes in it feel realer.
And you're going to say that.
Yeah. And it felt like, you know, more, I don't know how else to say it, but more was at stake in The Dark Knight, and people could really die, and that tension that it brought, plus the, you know, that performance by Heath Ledger and not knowing what that Joker was capable of, just made it minute to minute watching The Dark Knight a more enjoyable experience.
No, and I mean, I totally agree with you there. And you think about the two, you know, scenes in particular with that you think about in each movie is all the people on the ferries.
Yeah.
And just kind of this like silence that overtakes those scenes, you know, versus the scenes at the end of Batman Begins, you know, when the train is barreling towards Wayne Tower with that little gadget in there, and the guy's like, if that thing crashes, the whole city's gonna blow, and he says it like three times. And it's just a little bit too amped up. So I agree. You know, there you have a little bit finer handling of the stakes in the movie. But, you know, again, when you're dealing with comic book movies, to a certain extent, you have to accept the kind of unrealistic exaggerated elements. So that's why Batman Begins, for me, kind of setting it back in reality just worked so well.
Yeah, but that's the same argument I'm making with the importance of a performance like Heath Ledger's. It is a comic book movie, and the villain in a comic book movie is a important part of the story, and I think that just elevated that movie up, you know, rather than trying to say, oh, well, think how smart the other villain was or how subtly it was used. It just, I feel like your visceral reaction to, you know, watching one movie over the other is going to be impacted by that villain.
Well, thank you for joining us again for the Get Your Film Fix podcast. We'll be back pretty soon, and we really mean it this time, right? Not another 2 years until the next one. when we'll either be looking at Three Billboards in, what's the full title again?
Ebbing, Missouri.
Ebbing, Missouri, or
of Melchior Estrada. Yeah.
or Phantom Thread. I've been Chapin Hemingway with Lee Carlo and Jeremy Fisk. As always, thank you for joining us.
I'm staying. I'm finishing my coffee. Enjoying my coffee.
And I'll how many beers do you have? I'll bring like
I don't have a lot. I probably have about 12.
But, all right.
So I also put that beer that you gave me at your wedding in the mug in the fridge. We can all share that.
Nice. You still have it from the wedding? Wow.